The following presentation was recorded live by Voices from Jerusalem.
So someone asked me yesterday a question, by the way. I wanted to add a comment in before we go further. They asked me, what would like a secular professor in college think of what I'm saying, you know, history? So again, without getting into what people would think of what I teach, it's very important, by the way, if you're a student of history, to realize that you can look at history through many different glasses. And I'm reading a very interesting book. It's called Guns, Steel, and Viruses, or something like that. It's by a guy named Jared Diamond. Very interesting book, understanding why it is that certain the West came to dominate, what environmental factors, cultural factors. You can look at history from many different respects, because all kinds of things, even disease, plays a huge impact on how different cultures develop. So you can, Jewish history, look at, I like to call it, you know, the problem we have, and the problem people might have with some of the information I'm giving over, if you're like a secular historical professor, is the history we've learned when we grow up or we were in school is the history of power. Okay, the big battles, the big empires. Now, I know today with multiculturalism, that's sort of out. But the bottom line is the people who make the noise get the attention. Okay, Jewish history, I like to call it like in the words of the Bible, the famous story of Eliyahu when he goes to the mountain in the desert after running away from Jezebel the witch, you know, and he hears the still small voice. And the Jewish history is this, it's not the history of power, okay? It's the history of ideas. It's subtle history. It's below the surface. It's behind the events. So when we look at the history and that, you put those glasses on and you look at the history, you can see things in a totally different way. It doesn't change the events. It only changes how we understand the events. So it's very important we do all of this to keep that in mind. You can go study history from 10 other professors. It all merges together. But we're talking about really the ultimate cause and effect scenario here that's behind the scenes. And I think by the end, people will appreciate how it really does all fit together very, very nicely. Okay, with that introduction, let's go back and pick up where we left off. We're following in our outlines. We are over, again, in the book of Genesis, in this 500 years to the birth of the nation of Israel, in phase one, the development of the family of Israel. The theme of this whole first book of the Bible, again, is the story of the creation of the family that's going to carry on the mission, okay, to bring the idea of God into the world and re-elevate humanity back to its ideal state. And we're going through a process here. We have these one, two, three, four generations. It's very interesting. We'll see. One of the themes and patterns that's very nice in this period is that it's sort of like a filtering process. Each generation is going to have, the first two generations, Abraham is going to have two children by two different wives. We talked about Ishmael already and Isaac. Okay, one goes off, doesn't carry on the mission, but nonetheless becomes a great nation. And in some way is going to actualize some of what is the essence of Abraham, right? It's going to create a great monotheistic faith called Islam. It's going to come out of the Arabs. Okay, the Arabs are going to be known for their hospitality, something that Abraham was known for. Isaac, however, carries on the mission. Now, Isaac... Now, I don't want to go into all the stories of Isaac's life. This isn't a Bible class. But again, remember we're talking about the actions of the fathers are assigned to the children. There's some really important patterns that we have to pay special attention here. One of my favorites is a story, which is not a hugely significant story in the Bible, but it's very important vis-a-vis our understanding of how we interact with Gentiles. You know, part of this idea of the actions of the fathers are assigned to the children is that what Abraham does is going to be repeated by Isaac and by Jacob. Okay, sort of like making a... If you know a wagon that drives through a dirt path, even on a stone path for a long period of time, makes a rut. And you get stuck in the rut. After a while, the wheels, I was just in a couple of days ago, I was in Sipori up north, which is a city from a Roman Byzantine period. We were walking along an old Roman road. And you could see the stone. The Roman roads are incredible. They built them, they last for thousands of years. Would that they build roads the way the Romans built them today. You know, much, much better back then. But this road was used for so long, you can see ruts in the road, like a real visible groove that you can trip over if you're not careful. And the problem with the groove is once you get in, it's hard to get out. If you establish a good pattern, which is a lot like habits, you establish a good pattern, you stay in it. You establish a bad pattern, the rabbis say also, once you do something three times, it already becomes permissible and positive. You know, and so too we say there are patterns, they're like ruts in history. Whatever groove Abraham is going to carve, for better and also anything bad, any problems we have are going to create grooves that we're going to get stuck into as a people. Unless we take the trouble of filling in the grooves, you know, put some asphalt down there, dig up the paving stones, put new ones in, which is a lot of work, we're going to be haunted by those patterns throughout history. So on one hand, we're going to see a repetition of the stories microcosmically from one generation to the next. And again, as I said previously, these are going to be patterns for the future. One of the great patterns you see here with Isaac is something that happened with Abraham previously. It says Abraham went down to the Philistines and he lived amongst them for a while. He had some problems and some interactions with them. Right? They tried to take his wife, Sarah. It's an interesting story. I want to go back to that. Isaac is in the same situation. He's living amongst the Philistines somewhere in the coastal area of Israel. And it says that his servants start to have problems with the servants of, you know, Abimelech, the king of the Philistines. And what do? Isaac's servants dig wells, and the Philistines cover them up. And they dig more wells, and the Philistines cover them up, and so on and so on and so on. Okay, it's very interesting. To cover up a well in the Middle East is insane. You know, okay, take the well, you know, use it for yourself. But the most valuable commodity here is water, okay? It's, you know, it's an insane idea. And what happens eventually? The Philistines basically throw Isaac out. He hasn't done anything to deserve it. There's no background saying the Jews did anything wrong here. He's thrown out. And then what happens? Then the Philistines, Abimelech, the king, comes after Isaac. And he says, I see that we prospered because of you. You know, because once they left, you know, things go downhill for the Philistines. Their economy kind of collapses. The stock market doesn't do so well. The bagel store closes, you know. Nothing's doing so great. So the Philistines realize it's because of the Jews. So he comes and he says, let's make a treaty. Like, you won't hurt us. Like, as if, you know, Isaac is in a position to hurt the Philistines. As if he did anything to deserve being in. This is the great pattern of Jewish-Gentile interaction in history. This is a groove that is unbelievably clear. What's the story of Jew in diaspora? Jews are invited into countries often. The country does incredibly well because of us. Okay, we do well, they do well. And then for no reason, I'm aware of virtually no example in Jewish history of Jews ever doing anything that caused them to be hated the way they're hated. You know, like, for no reason, suddenly it appears Jews are dangerous for some reason, we got to get rid of them. So the Jews are thrown out, the country suffers. This is what's going to happen over and over again. Jews invited in, country does well, for no apparent reason, Jews are thrown out. Jews are often going to be expelled in history more than once from the same place. Why? Because the Gentile, after the Jew is thrown out, realizes that without the Jew, we're not doing too well. I've seen letters of different communities where Jews were expelled because of decrees of local authorities begging that the decrees be rescinded because they realized that when the Jews left, the economy falls apart. I've seen letters, people like the Bishop of Spire, and wanting Jews in his community in medieval Europe, realizing that if you want to make a small town into a great city, you got to have Jews. And then, of course, the Jews will be expelled a few generations later. This is the great pattern that we're going to see repeated over and over again. And I say it can be characterized by one sentence. Can't live with them, can't live without them. Which is a line that a redneck friend in college said about women. Can't live with them, can't live without them. Never use that line on your wife. But it's obviously a line that's used with the Jews all the time. Okay? We hate them. It's such an interesting love-hate relationship. We can't stand you Jews, but we need you. It's schizophrenia. It's such a weird relationship. But you see it here, and we'll repeat it over and over again. So that is interesting idea, big interesting idea we see in the Isaac story. Now I want to jump ahead and talk about Isaac's children. His wife, we see over here, Isaac marries Rebekah. And by the way, all the men are marrying women who are their cousins. It's all from one family back in Mesopotamia, back in Haran. Okay? Isaac is married to Rebekah. Rebekah is pregnant with twins. Okay? Those twins, it's interesting, they're fighting in the womb. They're fighting in the womb. And when they're born, there's a rivalry between them. And what are the twins' names? Jacob and Esau. Now, I have, myself, identical twin girls. Okay, they look alike, their personalities are different, but they look similar. Jacob and Esau not only are totally different personalities, but they also are physically very different. The Bible describes Esau as being a hairy guy. Must have been really hairy, because look at the descriptions of what Jacob has to do to fool his father into thinking he's Esau. And he's also a hunter. He's a man of action. Isaac is a smooth guy. Not smooth in terms of how he talks. He's smooth in terms of his skin. Yaakov is a smooth guy. And he's also Ishtam Yoshev Ohalim. He is the Shiva Bacher. He's the Shiva Bacher. He sits in the tent. He reads the books. He's got the glasses. He's not a big man of action. Okay? And there's definitely rivalry between the two, but they're very different personalities. And it's also clear from the narrative that Isaac is favoring Esav, who's the firstborn of the twins. He's a couple minutes older, but he's the firstborn, like with my twins. One is 6 minutes older than the other. She still knows she's older. You know, she's the big girl. And Rebekah is clearly favoring Jacob, which is an important lesson, by the way. We see over and over again, the Torah says that women have, like, bina yisera, an added intuitive intelligence. You'll see, please God, you all get married. Women definitely know what's right. Over and over again in the Bible, the men make the stupid mistakes, the women do the right thing. We'll see it in the patriarchs with their wives, with them being clear about what reality is all about. You'll see it in the story of the Exodus, and you name it, with the women not worshiping the golden calf, mostly, and the women not believing in the spies. Okay, it's definitely a guy thing to make the mistakes. Okay? So, there's an interesting story that takes place where Isaac is old, and he's blind, and he wants to give a blessing to his sons. Okay, and he wants to give a special blessing to his firstborn of his sons, Esav. Now, blessings are not, you should be blessed. A blessing by a great man like an Isaac, who is a prophet, is the ability to take spiritual forces and make them a reality. To give you a slight example of what that would be, imagine you have a friend who has incredible insider information on the stock market, which is, of course, illegal to pass in, you know, insider trading. But he calls you and he tells you, I have like 10 tips. If you give me $1,000, I'll turn it into $1 billion within 1 year for you. You know, that's a guy who has power, you know? So how much more so a person who can focus spiritual forces? So it was something that was really meaningful to Esav, who didn't really want the responsibility of being firstborn, to get this blessing, which was physical, you know, wealth and power. He definitely wants that. Now, Rebecca realizes that that's got to go to Jacob. So while Esav's off hunting to get a dinner to bring to his father, so he'll bless him, what does she do? She takes Jacob. First of all, she takes kid gloves. She takes, like, goat skin. He must have been really hairy. Think about it. Like, Planet of the Apes kind of guy. Puts it on his hands. He walks in, as if he's Esav. He says, come sit down, father, and eat, and you'll give me a blessing. And Isaac, you know, who, again, can't see very well, he says, you know, the voice is the voice of Jacob, the hands of the hand. Kol kol Yaakov, hayadayim yadei Esav. He says, you sound like Jacob. Come here, I want to feel you, you know. Ah, but you feel like Esav. Now, it's a huge mistake to read the Bible stories on a simplistic, like, first grade Sunday school level. This is not the story of some, like, kind of old, somewhat senile, blind old guy who's just confused. There are very profound things going on here. Okay, I don't want to get into all of that for your Bible classes, but very profound. Just think about it for a second. Hakol kol Yaakov. The voice is the voice of Jacob. This is about a great little vort I heard from Rabbi Matthias Weinberg, who is the nephew of our Rosh Hashiv, Rabbi Noach Weinberg. He lives in the Jewish Quarter. What's the voice symbolic of? When Isaac says, the voice is the voice of Jacob, what's the voice symbolic of? Word, speech, is a uniquely human function. It is, by the way, the place where physical meets, you know, speech is your vocal cords vibrate, meets the intellectual spiritual, an idea. Meets your voice, comes out as a word. A kol kol Yaakov means, and who does Jacob become in history? Israel. They change his name to Israel. He becomes the Jewish people. Speech is intellectual, spiritual power is what the Jews are all about. That is our area of expertise and dominance in the world. That's where we're made to make an impact. The voice is the voice of Jacob. Hayadayim yadei Esav. The hands are the hands of Esav. What's the hand indicative of? By the way, just as the voice is uniquely human, animals don't have a voice, they can make sounds, so too the hand of a human being is also unique. A chimpanzee or an ape does not have a thumb that faces like this, it's like this. Even one of those Planet of the Apes monkeys, you know, Baby Milo, whatever, you seen that movie, doesn't have the manual dexterity of a human being. Okay, these are two uniquely human aspects that they represent two different forces. What's the hand representative of?
Action.
I love that one. The sword. We have word, add an S, you get sword. Okay? Close. One letter difference. Very different spheres. Esav represents physical power. Sword, dominance, conquest. Okay? So what do we have? Spiritual power, Jews. Physical power, Esav. Jews, right? We're going to see. We're going to develop out of Jacob. Who does Esav become? According to the chronology. Amalek is one of the... But who did he become first? Now, remember we mentioned going back to Ishmael. Ishmael, who doesn't carry on the mission, nonetheless becomes a great nation. One of the two great monotheistic faiths of the world is going to come out of Ishmael, which is Islam. What's the other great monotheistic faith?
Christianity.
Christianity is a product of what nation? What empire? But what name? We know, Rome. It's called the Roman Catholic Church before it splits into Eastern Orthodoxy and then Protestantism. It's a product of Rome. Rome, from the Jewish tradition, comes from Edom. Edom comes from Esav. The chronology is right there in the Bible. So we see yet another example of an offshoot of the children of Abraham, not carrying on the mission, yet becoming much greater, by the way, than Ishmael. the greatest, you know, talk about the hands of the hand of Aesop, the greatest physical power in human history is West, is the West, the rise of the West. Greece, followed by Rome, followed by Western civilization. Hands down, certainly in the last 500 years, completely dominated the world. Okay, very interesting pattern going on here. And we see, now obviously this is not, we're talking about a cosmic struggle here. These two guys are fighting, you know, in utero. They're going to be fighting throughout history. The battle, the ultimate cosmic, you know, end of days scenario, Gog and Magog, all that stuff is going to be between, it's between two very lopsided forces, the Jewish people, little people, and West, Rome, the power of Aesop in human history, Western culture, yeah.
And now, America is definitely part of the West.
And yeah, and it's part of the...
They've been the ace in our...
Well, America is interesting because Christianity is a synthesis of Judaism and a lot of other things when you talk about Christianity. So America is, you know, it's like the red, white, and blue. The blue is Jews. It's in the flag. It's in there also. You know, I always hold the countries that are least like the Jews have the most red in their flag. That's Edom. The Soviet Union, I think, is not without accent. All those communist countries have all those red flags, you know. There's definitely, America is an interesting synthesis. I'm not saying it evil, by the way. I'm not saying it. There's a lot of great, you know, saying any descendant of Western culture is an evil person and they all hate the Jews. Obviously, Max is making a great point. The greatest supporter of the modern state of Israel is the United States, although they have their own agenda also, you should know. Yeah, but I'm saying the ultimate struggle, which doesn't mean that all the countries of the world are going to make an alliance and invade Israel. I'm saying it's a struggle which is not so clearly defined who the bad guys are. Within Western culture, there's good guys and there's bad guys. But I'm saying the ultimate struggle in human history. And you're going to see it much clearer, not so much now, because now everything's mixed up. But you see between Rome and Israel. And when we get to Rome, we'll talk about what a cosmic struggle the rabbis viewed that as. One is going to be up, one is going to be down. They both can't be up at the same time. It's not an even battle ever. Rome will always have the physical side. But the true strength of the Jews is going to be the intellectual, spiritual side. But this is the struggle. So we see this is where it begins. And it's going to carry on throughout all human history. So we have an incredibly important groove in a pattern. And by the way, another great lesson to come out of all of this is not just that the descendants of Abraham can't not but be great. Even if they don't become Jews, they become peoples who have huge impact on the world. But that our greatest enemies come from our own family. Well, who's the ultimate enemy of the Jewish people in history? The Amalek, right? Incredible. This is the people we have a commandment to wipe off the face of the earth because their pathological hatred of us is so great that if given any chance, we'll talk about them a lot, they will try and wipe us off the face of the earth. Amalek is, you know, if you look, the genealogy is all there in the Bible. The Bible is very clear. It goes through the descendants of Yishmael and the descendants of Esau. They get together. Eliphaz from Esau, from Yishmael, they get together. It's funny, our cousins in different generations will marry together and create a hybrid form of enemy of the Jew called the nation of Amalek has a pathological hatred of the Jew. Interesting. The ultimate enemy of the Jews and come from within our own family. Offshoot. Amalek is a descendant from the Jew. Initially, you go back to their ancestry, they go back to the Jews. Which just goes to show you, you know, you can't pick your family, as they say. But this is a common pattern also. You jump ahead to the Spanish Inquisition. Thomas de Torquemada, everyone knows he has Jewish ancestry. Nothing worse than a Jew who wants to prove that he can out-Gentile the Gentiles. Okay, there's nothing worse than that. We'll see. Okay. And by the way, and just to make this a little more clear, Rashi, in Genesis 33:4, he says, he brings in a great quote. He says, Omar Rav Shimon bar Yochai, Halacha chi biyadua she'esav sone et Yaakov. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, who's the guy who's credited with being the author of the Zohar, who's hiding from the Romans. Okay, this is a very famous character in Jewish history. We're talking about much later in history. But Rashi is quoting Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai as saying, it's a halacha that Esav hates Yaakov. Halacha meaning it's in their nature. It's sort of like a way of the world. There's the laws of gravity and there's the laws of interaction between Jew and descendants of Esav. They're going to hate us. It's deep-seated. To quote Menachem Begin, who's never one to pull his punches. You know, he said, the Poles are anti-Semites. They drink it in their mother's milk. And we don't know, we thank God didn't raise in Poland. He was, believe me, if you lived in Poland before the Holocaust, during the Holocaust, after the Holocaust, you go there now, it's unbelievable. I'm not saying all Poles hate Jews, but unfortunately most of them seem to. But this is, you say it's sort of a reality. It's a reality in the world. Okay, very interesting idea. Okay, so we have this confrontation. Jacob steals the blessing. Okay, And then Esau shows up, and he realizes that Isaac realizes he's been tricked, and by the way, he says, and he'll stay blessed. He's not angry at Jacob. Because what did he realize? It's very interesting. Isaac realizes, and this is probably why he shows favoritism to Esau, we have a mission in the world. He saw that Esau was a man of action, and Jacob wasn't really doing anything. You know, now that he sees that Jacob can be a man of action, he can trick a guy like Esau, who's a real trickster and a liar and everything else, he can do the job. Now, Rebekah, realizing that Esau is not going to be happy and he's going to want to kill his brother, sends him back to Haran, okay, back to her father's house, Lavan, Mr. White. Never trust anyone named Mr. White. He's like the biggest crook in the Bible. Okay? And then we go through this interesting story. He shows up with Penniless, and he falls in love with his cousin, Rachel. And he wants to marry her, and of course, after working for 7 years to marry her, he's tricked into marrying the older sister, Leah. He has to work another 7 years. In the end, he ends up marrying four women, these two sisters and their handmaidens, Bilhah and Zilpah. This is Jacob. He has four wives. From that relationship will come ultimately 12 sons. Now, we're in generation number four. Unlike previous generations, there's no filtering process going on here, like where each generation one kid goes off. All 12 of these sons are going to be totally pure and righteous and dedicated to the mission. So after several generations, we finally come up with the core group, that extended family that is going to make the nation, that's going to change the world. Now, at the end of the story, despite Lavan, Mr. White's attempts to keep Jacob in poverty, Jacob manages to accumulate a big fortune, which is another great pattern in Jewish history, by the way. The Jew with his hands tied behind his back, when given the slightest opportunity, will do remarkably well, even in a very hostile business environment. Okay, just the Jewish drawing, pushing, with a little help from above, I'm sure. Jacob realizes that he has to go back to the land of Israel, because he has a mission, just as Abraham knows that the place where Jewish potential can be accomplished is only in the land of Israel, so too Jacob realizes he has to go back there also. So he gathers up all his belongings, and he heads back. And this brings us to another scene, which is a tremendously powerful pattern in Jewish history, the reuniting of Jacob and Esau. And Esau, Jacob here, is coming out with a huge army. He's got like 400 men, which is a lot of men for a greeting party. Jacob sends gifts ahead to him. The reunion is one of the most interesting encounters, which is a huge pattern for Jewish history. They meet. Esau doesn't try and kill Jacob, although it's very clear from the commentators that he still hates his guts. But he says to him, look, Jacob, my brother, you know, it's good to have you back. You come with me to Har Seir. Come to where I live, Mount Seir. We'll go into business together, like we'll open up a used car dealership, you know, with your brains and my brawn. We'll dominate the whole Middle East. And by the way, there's no question, if these two had united as a team, what a force in human history. Imagine the physical power of Esau and the spiritual, intellectual power of the Jews together. Boy, is that a combination. We're going to see a little bit with Christianity, by the way, so a modified version. Jacob says, Yavor na lefanai, you go ahead of me, I'll catch up later. Now we know from the narrative, Jacob never goes to Mount Seir to live with Esau. But Rashi, again, the great medieval commentator, jumps in and says, and when will Jacob go to live with Esau or to meet Esau? And then he quotes from Ovadia, the prophet Ovadia, and he says, Va'alu Moshim mehartz Zion l'shpot atar Esau, and the Messiah will go forth from Zion to judge the mount of Esau, v'hayta Hashem amalucha, and God will be king, he will be anointed on that day, he'll be crowned, v'yomo yishayashem machad u'shmo echad, and on that day, God's name will be one. What day are we talking about? What's Ovadia talking about? What are all the prophets talking about? Right, the end of days. The end of days. Now, Rabbi Matthias Weinberg, again, a beautiful word he said on this. When Jacob says to Esau, you go on ahead, this is the Jews, the great physical, the great intellectual spiritual force in human history, saying to Esau, the great physical force, I give you permission to go on ahead and dominate human history physically. It's yours. This is setting a huge pattern of what's going to be. Esau is going to dominate the world. But in the end, Jews will end up on top, which doesn't mean in the end Jews are going to conquer the world and make a great empire. In the end, the whole world will come to recognize one God and live with one standard of morality and peace and brotherhood, right? The age of Aquarius, all that nice stuff. But in the meantime, Esau is going to be on top. And the struggle, ultimately, again, we see a restatement of this idea that the ultimate struggle will be between the Jewish ideas and the ideas of Esau and that culture that he's going to create in human history. That's the cosmic battle. As lopsided as it might seem, we say that's the real struggle. good versus evil, right? The few versus the many, the pure versus the impure. It's a very powerful idea and a super important pattern to understanding how we understand our history. When we get to the Romans, we'll see how much this is an idea in rabbinic literature and how much the rabbis are talking about it, because, again, Rome is the physical manifestation of that empire, which is derived from Esav. Okay. Okay, so let's now go ahead to the Joseph story. Now, Joseph, it's a fascinating story because here we have so many great patterns in these couple stories. Joseph is a very interesting character. He should have been really the firstborn son in the respect that really Jacob should have married Rachel first, and this was the first son of that relationship. There's a lot of interaction between Joseph and his brothers. He sort of has a position of leadership and dominance in the family. We see that because of Joseph being the firstborn son of his favorite wife, Rachel, Jacob is showing him favoritism, which seems to have been a mistake because it engenders a certain amount of jealousy. And by the way, it's a big mistake to read this story of Joseph and his brothers as like the ultimate dysfunctional family, intense jealousy story. The characters in the Bible, we have to remember, we're looking at people in the Bible, we're dealing with people on an incredibly high level, okay? But they're not perfect. They make mistakes, but they're on an incredibly high level. The mistakes they're making are not mistakes we make. Okay, this is not like Dallas, you know, General Hospital, you know, Melrose. We're talking about people who are at a very different level from us. And we have to, when we read the stories, we can't just read them simplistically where we learned them when we were 7, 8 years old. We have to look what's really going on here. And one of the deeper understandings of this story is Joseph, look, he's having all these dreams. And they're megalomaniac kind of dreams. Everyone's bowing to him, his father, you know, and his brothers. Now the brothers realize they are the team that's going to change the world. And we have a brother who thinks he's going to do it all by himself. He's endangering not only our family, he's endangering the whole future of humanity. This guy is dangerous. So they're doing it for the right reason. A lot of what they're doing, it's a mistake they made. But from their perspective, they had the right intentions. It wasn't like he has a nice coat and we don't, let's kill him. God forbid. I mean, I used to fight my little brother. I never contemplated killing him. He's got a toy. Actually, a couple times I may have contemplated killing him. I never brought it to fruition the way the brothers almost did. Instead of killing him, they sell him to a caravan. Yeah, any question? No, he wanted to marry Rachel first. He loved her, but he fell in love with her immediately, wanted to marry her, but he's tricked and he marries Leah. But his favorite wife, his true love, so to speak, is definitely Rachel. He has two children from that relationship. It's Joseph and his youngest Benjamin. Okay, those are the two. They are full brothers. Everyone else are half brothers. So what happens? Instead of killing him, they sell him to like some passing caravan, and he's brought down to Egypt, and he is sold into a servant of Pharaoh by the name of Potiphar. Now let's stop for a minute and look at Egypt. Egypt is a fascinating. We talked a little bit yesterday about, you know, early great civilizations, Fertile Crescent, the two earliest areas of civilization in this part of the world we have. One is, we talked about yesterday, where Abraham's from, Mesopotamia, the land between the two rivers, Tigris and Euphrates. That's a place we said which is, because it's no natural borders, whatever, is going to be conquered, very open area, a lot of people migrating through, a lot of trade. Egypt is the opposite. It's watered by the greatest river in the world. The Nile, I believe, is the largest river. It's also, I think, the only river that flows backwards, like from south to north. And it's a very unusual place geographically. Think about it. It's in the middle of a desert. If it wasn't for the Nile, there'd just be sand there. In ancient times, 3% of Egypt was inhabitable arable land, which is the teeny part of the land. I've been to Egypt. It's fascinating. You take a train down the Nile, which stops about every 50 feet, so it takes you about 3 days to go, you know, 2 miles. But you stop along the way, and you see, except for Alexandria at the top, where the Nile is a delta, and it's a big piece of land, and it's a floodplain also. Down below, a couple hundred yards on either side of the Nile is green, and everything else is like, you know, nothing. Which means that Egypt is in a very different geographic situation than Mesopotamia. It was virtually impossible to invade Egypt. Egypt is almost never invaded in human history. I mentioned it was invaded by the Hyksos, the Assyrians invaded once, and then finally Alexander the Great. But that's like 3 times in 3,000 years. It's the most static, continually longest surviving culture in human history, and virtually didn't change, by the way. No great. You think about how little Egypt changed in 3,000 years and how much the modern world has changed in the West, and even a few hundred years, it's mind-boggling how stable that society was. And to a large extent, it was due to the geographic reality of the country. So that's, and it's, again, it goes back early Egyptian civilization. We don't have exact dates for these things, but it's very, very old. We're talking about the beginning, early
Bronze period, 3200 BCE, the earliest Egyptian dynasties, which are going to grow into a great empire at certain periods of time in history. And these are people, as a culture, we realize this is a very sophisticated culture. Sophisticated technologically, the things they built. We're talking about 4,500 years ago. Anyone been to the pyramids? Incredible feats of engineering. Pyramids are giant tombs. Okay, the Great Pyramid, Cheops, it's close to 500 feet tall, 5 million tons of stone, put together by people who did not have any metal tools. And if you look at the building, it's incredible. Most of the stone, the outside coating, has been stolen and used for other things. But a few places you can see, you can't fit a credit card between these stones. It's unbelievable how they built.
Do they know how they got around to doing all that?
They surmise that they know. There's a lot of things Egyptians could do and the ancients could do that we can't do. Certainly, we could maybe do them with our technology. We have no idea how they did them. They had tremendously sophisticated stone cutting techniques. They had tremendously sophisticated engineering knowledge that enabled them to move large blocks of stone with the knowledge of engineering, which didn't have engines. They had pulleys, they had levers, they had a lot of sweat and blood. Look, the Great Pyramids, Cheops took something like 30 years to build. Why spend so much effort on building a tomb? Because Egypt was also an incredibly, you know, spiritually deep, impure spirituality, but very deep spirituals. Their book is the Book of the Dead. How's that for a real lively book to read? They believed that Pharaoh was a living god. He had absolute power. And that Pharaoh's position in the afterlife, how he did, would affect how the whole all of Egypt would do. So you had to make a really good tomb for him, and you had to give him the right gifts. You had to make sure that he got into the afterlife correctly. Otherwise, things would go bad for us, which is why it was the entire national project of the Egyptian people to create tombs for the pharaohs when they're going to die. But we're talking about a very sophisticated culture. Mummification, all the things they could do. We have to remember, it's a very important lesson. You look at the ancient world, we are so arrogant into thinking that we're so much more sophisticated than people in the ancient world. We may have technology they didn't have, but in many ways they are much more sophisticated than we are. There's things they did that we don't know how to do today. I was in the States a few weeks ago, and I happened to be in someone's house, and they had a TV, and I was watching the National Geographic Channel. What a great channel. And they had a guy, really morbid. He was mummifying someone. They got someone to donate a body, and he takes his old Egyptian records, and he goes back to Egypt, and he gets the salts, and they show him cutting the thing, taking the organs out. And they did it. And he actually successfully copied a technique, which hasn't been done in like 3,000, 2,000 years. And it works. The only reason why we know how to do it is because he reads the ancient Egyptian documents. But that's incredible stuff.
Did they transpose it into English?
Yeah, you can get all this. You want to try mummifying someone? Yeah, you can read. You can read a lot of stuff. Yeah, they have extraterrestrials. What about them? X-Files? What about extraterrestrials? We don't know. That's out of this class. That's in the. That's in Cosmic History 101. Okay, so we're dealing with a very sophisticated culture. We're dealing with a culture that, again, is from the Jewish perspective, is antithetical to Judaism as humanly possible. Totally into idolatry. If you've been to Egypt, you've seen, if you studied about ancient Egypt, you realize. I was in the museum in Cairo years ago. They have a room called Gods. It's this huge room with all these glass cases with little Getchkal idols everywhere. You know, it's the kind of room you can't bend down and tie your shoe in. People think you're worshipping idols in it. Every tomb, you know, they got all these Nut and Ra and this guy and you know, all these different gods. They had 2,000 gods in ancient Egypt. And they had hippo heads and falcon heads and funky crocodile heads. We're dealing with a civilization that was idolatrous to the extreme, very religious. And we're not talking about, you know, stupid mumbo-jumbo. We're sophisticated people who truly believed in the power of idolatry. When we talk about Moses and miracles, I want to go back to this because this has to do a lot with our notion of what is sophisticated and what is primitive. There's definitely something to all of this. It's not a bunch of superstitious primitive people. We're dealing with a very advanced intellectual engineering sophisticated civilization. So to throw little boy Joseph into this environment is bad news. Okay, very bad news. And he, by the way, we're talking about patterns for the future, the actions of the fathers, sign for the, you know, the children. Joseph is the classic case, this whole section that we're getting in now, down to the bottom here, of going down to Egypt. And the Exodus story is a real amazing paradigm for what's going to be in Jewish history. And Joseph is one of the first diaspora Jews. I mean, he's living outside the land of Israel. At the time was the land of Canaan. He's in an environment that is very hostile. He has no support system. Okay? Now, Egypt, besides being very into idolatry, was a very licentious place. Okay? They were really into immorality, at least the Jewish sources say they had a... Now, Joseph has another disadvantage. Besides being separated from his family as a teenager, he's also, like from the Jewish sources, one of the best-looking guys ever. He makes, you know, Brad Pitt, you know, Tom Cruise look very mediocre. He's gorgeous. So he has all of these Egyptian women. He's a teenage guy chasing after him, including Potiphar's wife. It says, as a matter of fact, that Potiphar's wife, she used to invite all of her girlfriends in, and she'd give them all oranges and knives. The Midrash describes the story. And then she called Joseph, the servant, in, and they would be like, they'd look at him, and they're like, their tongues would hang out, and they'd slice into their hands right through the, you know, right through the fruit. All of them at once. So this poor guy, he's stuck in the situation. Now Joseph rises. No comment. Joseph rises. He's on a higher level than you and I, that's for sure. Joseph rises from his position as lowly teenage servant to head of Potiphar's household. He's got all the big keychain, opens all the storehouses and everything. This is the classic case of the Jew in diaspora. Comes in, arrives in a bad situation, impoverished, rises to the top. Now Potiphar's wife is not happy that Joseph refuses to meet her advances. Eventually at one point she basically tries to rip his clothing off. He runs away. She screams rape. Potiphar comes home. It must be obvious that he didn't believe her, because otherwise he probably would have had her killed. But he can't allow him to stay in the house, so he gets thrown into prison. So what happens? Joseph arrives at the bottom, head servant, then he crashes. This is the Jew in diaspora. We come into a country, we rise, we're thrown out. We start at the bottom somewhere else. Joseph is now in prison, and he rises very quickly to be the head prisoner. He's running the whole place. He's like the chief capo. Okay, this is again the Jew. Into prison is thrown Pharaoh's wine steward and Pharaoh's baker. Now I'm running through these stories quickly because, again, this is not a Bible class, but there are some really interesting patterns in here we have to look at. Now they did little things wrong, but, you know, if Pharaoh's a god, and if he has a little piece of sand in his bread, it could be off with your head. You know? And they have dreams. Now Joseph's always interpreting dreams. Dreams are a huge thing for Joseph. And Joseph interprets their dreams, and he tells the baker, he tells the wine steward, Pharaoh is going to reinstate you into your position. He tells the baker, you're going to lose your head. And that's exactly what happens. The baker is executed, the wine steward is reinstated. And as he's leaving prison, Joseph says to the wine steward, maybe you'll put in a good word for me to Pharaoh. And of course, the wine steward promptly forgets about Joseph altogether for a couple of years. The moral of the story being, great pattern in history, Jews should never count on too much help from non-Jews in human history. It doesn't come too often. So he rots in prison for another 2 years. And then we jump ahead. We're at the end of the book of Exodus. I mean, the end of the book of Genesis, excuse me. Pharaoh has a dream of these seven fat cows coming out of the Nile, and then seven thin cows. And the fat cows eat the thin cows. And then he goes back to sleep again. And he has the dream of these seven sheaves of wheat, fat sheaves of wheat, and then seven thin sheaves of wheat, and the thin ones eat the fat ones. And he's very disturbed. And believe me, if living God on earth, Pharaoh can't sleep, none of Egypt sleeps. So he wakes up all of his magicians and his soothsayers and his, you know, astrologers, and none of them could figure out what the dream is about. And then the wine steward says, I remember there was this Nar Ivri, like this Jewish kid, one of the only times we see the word, you know, Hebrew used in the Bible there. Little Jewish kid in prison with me, and he interprets dreams. Now this, by the way, is the ultimate Jewish success story right now. They schlep Joseph out of prison, probably in the middle of the night. They shower him, they shave him. He stands before Pharaoh. Pharaoh says, I had a dream. This is not the Martin Luther King speech. He says, I had a dream. My dream is X. Joseph says, no, that's not your dream. Pharaoh deliberately changed his dream. Joseph tells him what he really dreamed. Pretty cool, huh? And he says, not only is that what you really dreamed, but it means the following. There's going to be 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine. Pharaoh's like, whoa, awesome dream interpreter we got here. What should I do? And Joseph says, you better stockpile all the grain in Egypt. Okay. So that when the famine hits, we'll have what to eat. Pharaoh takes off his ring. He says, you thought of it, you do it. He becomes viceroy of Egypt. For all practical purposes, the most powerful man in the whole country in terms of day-to-day functioning of Egypt, of the most powerful empire at the time. How's that for promotion? Prisoner to viceroy. Okay, and he gets as a wife. Pharaoh gives him a wife, Osnat. Okay, Osnat is the daughter of Potiphar. It's amazing he ends up back in that family again. Before the famine hits, he has two children, Manasseh and Ephraim. Now, what's very interesting about Manasseh and Ephraim, we bless our children on Friday nights. You've been to someone's house and they bless their kids? You go to your daughters and you say, God should make you like Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. And then you'd expect that we go to our sons and say, God should make you like Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Moses. No, we say, God should make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. Yisim ka Elohim ka Ephraim ka Manasseh. Why those two guys? Why them? Of all the people you could think of, they're hardly the greatest characters in Jewish history. So there's two very nice thoughts that go along with these two brothers. One is that Manasseh is older than Ephraim, yet Ephraim is greater than Manasseh, but they're not jealous. Now, however well-intentioned Joseph's brothers are, there's a level of jealousy in there which is incredibly destructive. And we want our children to be like Ephraim and Manasseh, that they love each other regardless of who's up on top and who's greater, and they're not jealous of each other's accomplishments. Number two is these kids grow up as son of the viceroy. They could have been totally assimilated, spoiled Egyptian brats. Yet it's very clear they grow up as completely loyal proto-Jews in an incredibly hostile environment. And this is the first Jewish diaspora we got here. We want our children in the diaspora to have that same internal strength, that love for each other and that ability to survive in what is a very hostile environment. Okay, so that's why we bless them like that.
Even though we do that in Israel, where there's
not. Yeah, because we're still in diaspora. Even if you're in Israel today, we're in diaspora. When the temple, until all the Jews come back and the temple's rebuilt and we're all keeping Torah, this is diaspora. Okay? Which is why we still pray for Jerusalem to rebuild, even though we're sitting in a nice new building here. Because rebuilt means building a temple and the spiritual rebuilding of the Jewish people. Yeah. Diaspora is the Greek word for scattering. We'll talk about that a lot later. It's a good question, though. Okay, now, let's keep going with the Joseph story. I want to just finish talking about the reunification of he and his brothers. And then we're going to stop there. Now, Joseph, when his brothers sell him, they don't go back to Jacob and say, by the way, Dad, you know, your favorite, you know, son of your favorite wife, we sold him as a slave. No, they take his little beautiful coat, Tonet Pasin, that lovely coat that he had, special with the colors and everything. They rip it up. They put goat's blood on it. They bring it back to Jacob. And Jacob says, oh, my God, like some wild animal. And back then, they used to have lions here and everything in the ancient Near East. You know, some lion ate my son or something like that. And he goes into deep mourning. And by the way, Jacob's a prophet. When you're depressed, you can't have prophecy. No prophecy and Prozac together. It doesn't work. You've got to be in a state of joy. Joseph has never been in touch since that time with his family. Why? It's a good question. He could have sent a message, hi, Dad, I'm alive. On some level, Joseph definitely realizes that this is all part of a plan, and it has to work its way through the scenario. Everyone's got to bow to me. I had a dream. I know that dream is meant to come true. I have to wait till that scenario happens. Okay? So he's holding back. So for all these years, they're separated. Meanwhile, the famine hits. The famine hits the whole ancient Near East. Jacob sends almost all the brothers, but he doesn't send Benjamin back, because Benjamin is the only surviving son, Joseph's younger brother. He's the only surviving son of his favorite wife. He doesn't want to risk losing him. The brothers go to Egypt. They stand before Joseph. They don't recognize Joseph. Joseph walks like an Egyptian, dressed like an Egyptian, talks like an Egyptian. Of course, they're making the mistake of speaking about him in Hebrew right in front of him. Big mistake, by the way. You should always be careful. Like, never speak Russian in front of people on buses, you know, like in Israel. They all speak Russian. Yeah? So be very careful. He understands everything they're saying. Now, Joseph realizes that we've sort of created a groove in the ground here of hatred amongst us. We have to get rid of that. I have to get my brothers to do tshuva, the Jewish idea of repentance, which is not whip yourself a few times and say a few Hail Marys. Jewish idea of repentance, as Maimonides puts it, is you realize you've done something wrong. You commit not to do it again. You find yourself in the same situation and you don't repeat that mistake. You've changed. Joseph realizes he now has a great chance to put his brothers back in the same situation he was in to see if they've changed. He accuses them of being spies. You don't really have another brother back in Israel. And they start to figure out this is all happening to us because of what we did to Joseph. And now we have to bring our other brother. And if we have to bring our other brother, it's going to kill Dad. If anything happens to Benjamin, Dad's going to die. They should have realized, well, look what they did to Joseph. It almost killed their father. And he makes them go back. They come back. I don't want to go through the whole details. They come back with Benjamin. He sets Benjamin up. He threatens to imprison them and enslave them. And there's this big confrontation between Yehuda, his brother, and Joseph. And they're like going to come to blows almost. Oh, you got to let Benjamin go. Finally, Joseph realizes he can't withhold himself anymore. And he says to his brothers, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? And this is one of the great pregnant pauses in biblical literature. The brothers are just like, and by the way, the rabbis say that's what we're going to be like when you stand before God. No excuses, you're going to be nothing to say. And then he says what is clearly one of the most significant statements in terms of understanding Jewish history. He says, don't worry, I'm not angry. He says this a couple times. I'm not angry, you guys. This is all part of God's plan. God sent me down ahead of you guys to set up this scenario, because it's his will that you come down here and everything has to be into place. One of the greatest sayings of the rabbis, which explains Jewish history, is the idea of HaKadosh Baruch Hu Makdim L'Refuah L'Makah. God puts the cure before the disease. Remember I talked about this idea of we have a finish line, there's a goal, history is a controlled process, our decisions make a difference, but we're promised we'll get to the end. Therefore, regardless of what path we take, God will always make sure that we have a way out. He will put the pieces into place. Now, as they're happening, we don't see how they fit in. But when it's all over, we see it was done for a reason. Joseph, who's a very intelligent person, with tremendous belief and faith in God, realizes this is all part of a divine plan. I have to be down here because this is part of this huge cosmic historical process. That is Jewish history. I always say Jewish history is like a giant jigsaw puzzle, right? 6,000 pieces. Every piece is a year. You ever dump a 6,000-piece jigsaw puzzle on a table? Can you imagine? Like, take up the whole floor here. And has no picture on the cover to see what it's going to look like at the end? Forget it. You start with the corners, you know, because it's flat on one side. What's with the jigsaw puzzle? We know a puzzle. A big, huge puzzle like that, the first few pieces to get into play is going to take forever. But as you go further and further, a couple things happen. The picture comes together. You see everything fits. There's no extraneous pieces. And the closer you get to the end, the easier it is to put the pieces together. That's human history and certainly Jewish history. Everything fits. There are no accidents. It all comes together. Everything has a purpose. And when it's done, you look back and see. Makes sense. All fits. Joseph sees it. And then, just to end off our story, Joseph sends a word back to his father, Jacob. He says, I'm alive. Jacob is restored. His prophecy comes back. He's overjoyed. He thinks his son has been dead for all these years. I mean, think about it emotionally. If you thought, God forbid you lost a kid, you realize, you know, years later, he's still alive and you haven't seen him. And they have this dramatic reunion when Joseph comes out and all of Egypt comes out. It's a big thing, you know, they have this big thing. The viceroy's family has been found. They're going to be reunited. And they're all bowing to him, by the way. This is the fulfillment of the prophecy. You know, Jacob, even his father bows to him. You know, it's an interesting story. And Pharaoh invites the whole family to come live, which is where we are over here. 70 individuals enter Egypt. Okay, that's what the family has become now, which is Jacob, his 12 sons, their wives, their children. This is the proto-Jewish nation, arrives in Egypt. And again, this is a great pattern of Jews arriving in a diaspora country. They are welcomed in. They're given the best real estate in the land of Goshen, which is probably the great historical pattern for Jews being into real estate. They settle. Everything seems to be going great. The Jews prosper. We come to the end of the book of Genesis. I'm going to stop here now. And next.